This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who guards the system? We're going to talk about violence tonight. That'll be exciting. How is the war in Iran going? When's it going to end? We have a guest talking about that. We have a guest talking about the midterms. How are we looking? How can we make sure we win? All that and more coming up on I'm Right. Let's talk about violence, shall we? And look, this is about the system, but what is the true power of the system? And remember, if you're a new viewer, the system is what I call all the institutions in a society. Once they've been conquered by communists, they will, instead of keeping a check on each other, they will work together. The media works with the politicians, they work with the FBI, who works with the educators. They all work together to move the communist revolution forward. Okay, we got all that, but what is their true power? It's not these limp-wristed politicians. What is their true power? Well, let me ask you something. If you see somebody you don't like, maybe somebody who did something bad, what would happen to you if you grabbed that person and put zip ties on their hands and locked them in your closet for 5 years? You're going to go to prison because that's a felony. That's kidnapping. Please don't do that. You're not allowed to do that. What if you found somebody and you decided that person committed some kind of horrible act, murder, something like that? And so you grabbed them, tied them up, took them out in the woods and shot them in the head. What would happen to you? You're going to prison. Not allowed to do that. That's murder. Can't do that. Okay. But the government can. The justice system, and don't take this as some fruity liberal complaint about the justice system. You need a justice system that can arrest people, that can execute murders and things like that. I'm not saying that. But the justice system of any country, they are the ones who have a legal monopoly on really all acts of violence. The justice system, we empower it, we entrust it in a society to commit acts of violence on our behalf, in search for justice, to get bad guys off the streets, safety. There are a laundry list of reasons why we human beings entrust a justice system to that, but the justice system can and does commit acts of violence every single day. We want them to. It's legal. No one's going to arrest them. That cop who throws the handcuffs on the bank robber and takes him down to the jail and the bank robber gets locked up for 20 years, nobody's going to look at that cop and say, "Kidnapper!" We look at him and we say, "Thank you for your service, sir. Thank you for keeping us safe." Now, that's how society ideally works. But when you have an evil, corrupt system, a communist system, like the one we're drifting towards rapidly in this country, they will use that legalized violence for the revolution. And they do this by sending loyal communists and having them take over the justice system every level they possibly can. It's not one level. It's not one thing. It's judges. It's DAs. It's cops. It's FBI agents. It's look, pick your poison. But when they see the justice system, when communists see the justice system, they don't see it as a necessary thing for society to get bad people off the street. You know what they see? Ooh, legalized violence. We could probably hurt a lot of people we want to hurt if we take over that justice system. This is not unique. What is happening in America today is not unique. Every single communist system throughout history has done the exact same thing. They have installed their own people into the justice system and then used that justice system as a weapon against their political opponents. You, of course, remember we just had yet another assassination attempt on Donald Trump, but that's probably, honestly, That's probably soft pedaling it. We had an assassination attempt on Donald Trump. The guy, you said he wanted to kill them all. So that's Trump, J.D. Vance, Pete Hegseth, Marco Rubio. You know, the guy who ran through a metal detector and shotgunned a Secret Service agent in the chest with the intention of committing mass murder. Kind of a bad thing, right? Kind of, that's the kind of thing you should, well, I don't know. If he doesn't die at the scene, you should arrest him. He should be put on trial the next day. If convicted by a jury, you should have him swing from the gallows on national television and hang there for a couple days. That's an actual justice system. In this country, we have judges, I have to make sure I read the name, like Zia M. Faruqi. He just issued an apology to the assassin because he didn't like his jailhouse conditions. You know, this is the same judge that went on a rant after the January Sixers. He went on a rant about the January Sixers getting better treatment. You know why he's there. You know exactly why he was installed there. He was installed there to become the communist weapon against you, your country, and your values. And sadly, Mr. Faruqi, or whatever his dumb name is, he's not alone. He's common now. They're judges. They're DAs, they're FBI agents. Speaking of January 6th, do you remember all this?
That attack, that siege, was criminal behavior, plain and simple, and it's behavior that we, the FBI, view as domestic terrorism.
In the FBI's view, the top domestic violent extremist threat comes from racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, specifically those who advocated for the superiority of the white race.
Domestic violent extremism is the most acute threat, terrorism-related threat that we are seeing to our homeland. And as President Biden so powerfully put it, words do matter. Leadership matters.
Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic. No matter what the white supremacists and the extremists say.
What did they do? As soon as they took power last time, what did they do? Well, we know from this SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center indictment, we know that we had the FBI's domestic terror program staffed full of communists who hate you, who hate your guts. We know now from documents that are being released that we had people at the DOJ, people at the FBI, who declared war on you and your church. Remember, you do remember, right? That little FBI whistleblower thing where we found out the Richmond Field Office, which is, of course, only one of many, but we found out the Richmond Field Office had an intent to infiltrate the Catholic Church. This is what communists do when they take over the legalized violence of a country. By the way, Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche says this whole anti-Christian bias thing, don't think it was just one guy.
Is this just rogue prosecutors, a rogue FBI office, or was it a systematic culture within the Department of Justice and even beyond the Department of Justice under the last administration to target Christians, to target God-fearing Americans? And what we found in that very deep, substantial report is it was much more than just a rogue agent. It was much more than just a field office or a prosecutor. It was actually a systematic culture issue at the Department of Justice to target Christians, to target people based upon their religious beliefs. Extraordinarily disappointing. But President Trump said on day one that this was going to change, and I'm happy to report that it has changed.
A systematic issue. The system, you see. And these systematic issues, they don't happen by accident. This was always the intent. When you stuff the DOJ, the FBI, the judicial bench, when you stuff it full of committed communist activists, you stuff those people in there because you understand they will use the power of their office to wage war on your political enemies. I want you to watch this guy on MS Now. Look at this guy.
I have no doubt that Trump is going to issue a blanket pardon for every single person in the executive branch. But there are professional consequences.
Yeah.
Todd Blanche should remember that John Eastman, the intellectual architect of Donald Trump's, what I will refer to with a bit of prediction, the intellectual architect of Donald Trump's first attempt to carry out a electoral coup, was recently disbarred, and the appeal of his disbarment was denied. So Todd Blanche should watch his step a little.
Already suffering the consequences, rejected by the Met Club.
The Metropolitan Club here in Washington.
Good on them.
It's quite a threat. You know what that guy used to do for a living? You know where he used to work? He used to work at the FBI. Remember what James Comey said? This little warning on TV?
I know Republicans these days aren't big in thinking about principle or precedent. They're going to be deeply sorry that that disappears, because someday there will be a Democratic president and there'll be investigations of Republican office holders. If I'm them, I sure would want these career people in place, making sure that it's done in the right way.
Democrats aren't shy about it. They're talking about it all the time. They're campaigning on it. It's not like they do these things in secret. They'll stare right in the camera and they'll say over and over and over again, when we take power back, we're coming for our political opposition.
It's not about what a Democratic Department of Justice will do against Republicans. It's about trying to reestablish the rule of law. Will there be prosecutions? I certainly hope there will be prosecutions of anybody who is engaged in criminal acts against the United States and against corruption. But we can't just get into a cycle of political vengeance. That's playing the game of the liars and the hypocrites and the authoritarians.
There are so many different corrupt sycophants within the Trump administration, including but not limited to within the Department of Justice. Now, these people don't have immunity. And the reality is, the statute of limitations is 5 years, and there will be accountability with the next administration, if not before, when Democrats take back control of the House of Representatives.
They say it all the time. Just a little reminder, I thought it would be helpful, of what the stakes are if we lose upcoming elections. Now, speaking of those upcoming elections, Cliff Maloney is on the ground trying to figure out, how do we win these upcoming elections? We have a big one coming up in the midterms, and I'm curious how we're looking right now and what we need to do to make sure those dirty communists don't come back to power. We will discuss this with Cliff in a moment. Before we discuss that with him, I want you to have the energy to go out there and knock on doors and make phone calls. I want you to have the energy to wake up on a Saturday and say, what can I do to fight communists in this country? How do I go grab political power somewhere? And Chalk can give you all this with natural herbal supplements. The finest natural herbal supplements in the world are at Chalk. Go start. You are 60 to 90 days away from not needing naps anymore. You're at work. You're in a good mood. Life, every part of your life gets better. If you're a dude, male vitality stacks, clinically tested, 20% increase in your T levels in 90 days. You're about to be better in every possible way. Go to chuck.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. We have to win elections. It matters. These people who tell you that, well, elections don't matter, it's over, they're all ridiculous clowns, elections matter a lot, but we can't win once. We have to win again and again and again and keep the communists out of power. I'm highly invested in keeping the communists out of power. Joining me now, somebody, this is what he does for a living, Cliff Maloney. He wrote a book about it called Run Right. Want to know how to win elections? It's right there in a book. Okay, Cliff. We have midterm elections coming up. Just political history says you're going to face headwinds because you have power in the midterm elections. Why don't you talk midterms with us first? How are we looking? How can we do better?
Yeah, well, look, I think the first thing is, you know, people have to understand that, yes, of course, we're not supposed to do good. But I think the biggest problem we have right now is gas prices, right? And I'm not here to tell you the exact solution to that, but I'm telling you, based on the numbers, if we want to have a shot at keeping the U.S. House, you know, we're going to have to see that gas price come down. Outside of that, Jesse, the biggest thing that needs to happen is there has to be this shift. Now, it started in 2024. Charlie Kirk really pushed this, where the consultants don't understand that because of the rule changes, it is not an election day any longer. These are election seasons. Now, I've been on your show before. I've talked about this. We need folks to start adapting to understanding we have to turn out as many Republicans as possible and not focus all of our time on the persuadable middles. That's the Karl Rove messaging strategy of 2004. It's a different time, and we need the Republicans to adapt to that.
All right. How do we do that? How do I, normal citizen, get more people to turn out? Because for most people, they don't understand what that means. Even people watching right now, we show up, we vote. We just had local elections here. I showed up, I voted. And yes, of course, I texted friends and things like that. But what does that mean? How do we do it? What do we need to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, in a lot of these states, you know, Pennsylvania, where I spend a lot of time, there's 900,000 what we call Republicans that are registered to vote that are not expected to vote in 2026. So as much as it sounds like it's the same old adage, it is, Jesse. You got to talk to a lot of your friends, a lot of your family. If you're an individual who's not working with an organization or a committee or a group, you got to talk to these folks that are not usually voting, because that is it. If we get blue-collar folks to come out and vote, they're not going to vote for the communists, right? They're going to vote Republican. Some of the Republicans that we don't even like because they don't do anything. They have no spine. But at the end of the day, that's what's got to happen, is you have to be able to talk to those individuals that are normal, that are trying to pay their mortgage, they're taking their kids to baseball practice, but they're not voting. Those are the people we have to engage, and I think everybody has to do that. Campaigns, the party, different individuals, patriots. We've got to get the people unlikely to vote to come out and vote and motivate them to do so.
How do Democrats do this? Let me clarify. This is a totally loaded question. I've watched all these special elections that have been going on to see how we've been faring, and we've been getting our teeth kicked out of our face in these special elections recently. Why? Why are they able to turn their people out and we just are not?
Well, number one, they have the best motivator in the history of politics probably over the last century, and that is Trump derangement syndrome. I mean, it is, if you look at the numbers, what motivates Democrats is a fear of Donald Trump and a very simple message that is, you have to vote in order to stop Donald Trump and his fascist agenda. That's what they have going for them. Number two, they don't ever go home. Let me make this very clear for your viewers out there. There is no off year on the left. Look at the three congressional districts in Pennsylvania. We won them all by less than 5%. What did the Democrats do? They took 3 weeks off and they were back on TV and back on the ground. That's in December of 2024. Where Republicans, we just hang out and say, hey, we'll be back in August of 2026, 2 years later. That's the mentality. That's the shift that has to happen. But that's why Democrats are dominating. They're in these special elections. They're on the ground for 5 months with 100 full-time people for a state Senate race. They have endless money. Their organizations don't ever stop spending it, but they never send their people home. And by the way, Jesse, this is not the DNC. This is not the Democrats' state committees. Okay, these are 501c4 organizations where donations are not reported publicly, and they go out, they hire these people. These are W-2s. You want to talk about the No Kings protest? Where do you think this money's coming from? It's the 501c4s that have dark money. They've got W-2 employees. They work full-time. They do whatever the heck the Democrats need them to do, and they never go home.
All right, so let me ask a question that you just told me you don't know the answer to, which means I shouldn't ask it, but I'm going to anyway. Where's the money coming from? I realize we don't know. We can't officially know, obviously, but that is, as soon as you mentioned 100 full-time people, I'm immediately doing payroll in my head, and I'm thinking about the gargantuan amount of money that would cost, and that's one state race. They're doing this all across the United States of America. This has got to be $1 billion, billions of dollars, Cliff. That sounds billions. Like nation-state money to me.
Billions is absolutely correct. Now, the one silver lining we have here are the cuts that happened through USAID. We think a lot of that was going to these nonprofits, these NGOs, and it was funneling. Because when you go nonprofit to nonprofit, you're not really reporting those things, or at least you're not seeing who the original donors were, and it's not public. But look at Soros. Look at the Tides Foundation, the Ford Foundation. There are a bunch of these groups. They're all under this umbrella that we call Arabella. That's the Arabella Advisors. This is what the left organizes under. And they funnel all of the money from the mega donors to these organizations. But Jesse, your math is correct. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars. But I'm hoping that some of these USAID cuts And some of the fraud that's been exposed is going to make people slow down and not have the ability to pay off all these left-wing activists. We'll find out once we get to midterms.
Do they have more rich people than we do? Because you wouldn't think it if you're just thinking about politics in a base nature, but it seems like someone's writing bigger checks to them than they are to us.
Yeah, well, here's what I found in my time on the ground and kind of seeing who the players are. The problems Republicans have is we're not offering much in terms of handouts. We're not offering much to the lobbyists or to the special interests, at least not the patriots that run as Republicans, right? And that's a problem, because if you're a Democrat and government is the answer to all of your problems, well, then you can go to the special interests and say, hey, give me money, and in the budget, I'm going to make sure that we're funneling cash your way. And then it becomes this vicious cycle. So they're almost paying the politician through donations to then make sure they're included, they get their carve out, and it just keeps happening and keeps happening. This is why you don't ever see action, even from John Thune or Mike Johnson, because they need to be part of that action, right? This is the swamp doing what it does to protect all the special interests. So that is the problem we have. No, they don't have more rich people, but they have more that they offer through political corruption than we do, because we run on trying to shrink government, not expand it.
His book is Run Right. Go buy it and figure out how to win elections. Cliff, thank you, brother. I appreciate you very much. All right. What is actually happening in Iran with oil, the Iranian oil wells, the Strait of Hormuz? No propaganda. What's going on the ground? Talk to Ryan Macbeth about that. He is a wealth of information on this stuff. You're going to be so much smarter, and so am I. Before we get to that, let me give you a good night's sleep. A cup of hot chocolate. What's better than that? I was just at breakfast yesterday with my in-laws. My mother-in-law got a big old cup of hot chocolate, whipped cream on it. Everyone loves hot chocolate. Well, what if you could have a cup of hot chocolate before bed that had a bunch of natural things in it that'll have you drift off to sleep like a little bitty baby? That's Dream Butter from Beam. It's delicious. It's drug-free. All natural stuff in there. You just kind of drift off to sleep. And when you wake up in the morning, instead of having sandpaper eyes and thinking to yourself, this day's going to suck, when you wake up in the morning, you feel refreshed and ready to go. Go find out what I'm talking about at shopbeam.com/Jesse Kelly. We'll be back. All right, everybody has an opinion on Iran. Foreign policy is amazingly complicated anyway, and because there's so many different people lying about every different aspect of every kind of foreign policy, it's so hard to get actual information. What's happening? What's not happening? How are things looking? How long things are going to go? Let's talk to Ryan about this. Joining me now, Ryan Macbeth, open source intelligence analyst. His Substack, RyanMacbethSubstack.com. Well worth your time. All right, Ryan, Iran, let's set aside all the propaganda. How are things going? How much longer is this going to go on? Just the show is yours. What's happening?
Well, that's a tough one. You know, if I had a crystal ball, I would be on a boat making P. Diddy look like he was Amish, right? So I can't really give you a timeline of how long this can go on, but I can tell you this. With the blockade, what you're seeing is Iran losing between $450 to $500 million a day. And that would be tough for any country to absorb. So you may have a system where people aren't getting paid. The IRGC might not be getting paid on time. You could have people printing money, trying to put them in armored cars, sending out cash because their banking system was disrupted by coalition attacks. So the biggest issue facing Iran is they're going to run out of places to put oil. And that's a really big deal, because when you stop drilling for oil, when you shut down a well, apparently that oil sinks back down to the well. It makes it a lot harder to open. You have to use special chemicals and so on to get that well back open. So Iran is running out of choices. So they could theoretically burn that oil, but there's about 10 barrels of water in one barrel of oil. So you got to get the water out before you can even burn the oil. Or maybe somehow build a large clay reservoir where they can keep that oil out in the open. I mean, none of these options are good. But probably in the next 2-3 weeks, Iran is going to physically run out of oil storage space, and then it has to choose. Do we make some sort of concessions to the United States to let our tankers back out into the Gulf? Or do we just shut down these wells and possibly have a much harder time reopening them when this conflict is finished? So I've often said, in the military, you want to give your adversary problem or dilemmas, not problems. A problem has a solution, one or more solutions. A dilemma has two or more solutions, all of which are equally bad. So if Iran comes to the peace table and comes to some sort of agreement, they would almost certainly lose their nuclear ambitions. But if they don't have an economy in which they can build their nuclear arsenal. So there's two bad choices that Iran is facing right now.
All right, I have a laundry list of questions I want to ask you now from that little bit there. Now, first of all, obviously, when you mentioned the financial losses, that's staggering. I realize it's not a tiny country, but they're not the United States of America. That these are unbelievable and, as you mentioned, unsustainable losses. However, that's a logical way of looking at it. What do we do if they just don't submit? Because people have run into this before. Militarily, a country just doesn't say, I give up. What do we do from there? Or what happens to them from there? Do we sit back? Is there a revolution? What happens from there?
Well, ideally, there should be some sort of revolution. We haven't really touched the Artesh, which is, for lack of a better term, the civilian army of Iran. And I think the hope always was that the Iranian people would rise up and defeat the regime, and the Artesh might be a part of that, since a lot of young men are drafted into the Artesh. And the Artesh isn't particularly religious. Most Iranians are Muslim, the same way most Christians are Christmas and Easter Christians. The IRGC, they are the true believers. They are the ones who are trying to fulfill the coming of the Mahdi, which is this prophet-like figure that will join with Jesus at the end of the world and go and defeat the Antichrist and then have peace on earth for, I believe, either 9 or 19 years before the final judgment. And the IRGC people, they kind of want to move this thing along. Now, when it comes to what we can do, we can maintain a blockade against Iran theoretically indefinitely. We'll have to swap out ships as they go back to port for refit and having crew rotation. But we can keep this up far longer than Iran can hold out. So the ideal situation is that Iran has some sort of revolution where the people just can't stand this anymore. The less ideal solution is a peace treaty where Iran comes to the table, they say, you know what, we will give up our nuclear weapons, we're going to stop being jerks around the Sea of Hormuz, we're going to stop building long-range missiles, and from that, then we have inspectors and so on to make sure they're fulfilling their end of the bargain, and sanctions that snap back into place if they decide they don't want to play ball.
All right, now let's shift to something else. You mentioned these oil wells. It's not a light switch where you can just flip it on and off. Yeah. If they stop pumping, there are consequences there where you're not going to get it going again, or it's going to take you a while. That brings me to the oil flow of the entire planet. Yeah. What are the consequences, economic consequences, to all of planet Earth if Iranian oil gets taken off the market? Are they significant? Is it nothing? What is it?
Well, I believe 90% of Iran's oil went to China. The big issue right now is that there are a lot of tankers that are in Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, and they are afraid to transit the Strait of Hormuz, not because it's mined. I actually don't believe the Strait is mined, but you don't need a mine to make a minefield. You just have to make people scared that their ship could run into a mine. And one of the things I've often said is if I offered you a 95% chance at winning $1 million, but a 5% chance that you owe me $10,000, you'd probably take that bet, right? But a tanker owner never would. And the reason is actually very simple. I've likened this to Uber drivers. if you are an Uber driver and you get into a car accident, yeah, your insurance company will pay to replace your car. But you lose out on all the revenue that you could have earned had you been driving for Uber in that time it takes the insurance company to replace your car. If you are the owner of a container ship or an oil tanker, you want a 0% chance of being hit by a missile or a drone or a mine, because then if your ship sinks, you will lose out on all the revenue that you would have gained had that ship still been afloat and making deliveries. So to a lot of people who own tankers, it's just cheaper to keep those tankers in the Gulf waiting for any kind of opportunity for Hormuz to reopen to general traffic. Now, I can tell you this, when it comes to the world, we're really thinking about China, because 90% of Iran's oil went directly to China. So we're talking Chinese gas prices are at $4.16 a gallon. Pretty expensive. It's down a little bit from last month, but up significantly from what it was back in February. Now, the rest of the world is suffering from a lack of oil coming from the Persian Gulf. That is an issue. I believe in Europe, it's up to $7.88 a gallon. Now, yes, in Europe and in China, they price it per liter, but I altered this for an American audience. We understand per gallon. I believe in the Netherlands, it's something like $11 a gallon. It's extremely expensive there. But here's the deal here. If we can successfully patrol and use maritime surveillance aircraft and ships to successfully move ships through the Strait of Hormuz, and we still keep the blockade of Iran on, then we have people transiting the strait. The rest of the world economy is fine, and Iran gets to suffer. So that is not something that is of little consequence to Iran. Iran watches their neighbors continue to get rich, and meanwhile, they can't pay their bills. So that is certainly something that we can do. It just takes time to put all the pieces into place. The United States has a lack of escort ships. This has been a big problem since 2006 when we eliminated the Oliver Hazard Perry class frigate from our naval arsenal, and we replaced it with the LCS, the Littoral Combat Ship, which didn't quite work the way we expected it to work. And of course, our new Constellation class frigates, those were held up in manufacturing and eventually canceled. And now we're creating a new frigate that's based off of the Legend class Coast Guard cutter, but that's going to take a couple of years. So we do have a lack of ships that can escort, which is one of the reasons it's so important that Europe gets involved in these missions. We can scrape together enough assets, but it's going to take some time to get that done, and it's going to take a lot of coordination between ships, between maritime patrol aircraft, between helicopters that we're using, like the Apaches that destroyed 6 or 7 Iranian speedboats the other day. And also, we have to worry about unmanned surface vehicles, which are essentially drone boats. So those are really hard to spot, so we need to come up with countermeasures against them.
Brian, I could have you on for another 10 minutes, but I'm out of time. That was wonderful. Thank you, brother. I appreciate you so much. Go check out the man's Substack. What a mess. You know, paying 20-30% interest, that's a mess. Is that you? You have this high interest debt. You own a home. You have a solution. I take that back. American Financing, in collaboration with you, has a solution. This is what they do. You have a home. You have high interest debt. You have a way out. Call them and hear how they can help you. Don't sit and burn 20-30% interest. That's lighting your money on fire. And by the way, it's not insurmountable. I know that's how it feels when you're paying that. I'll never get out. I'm making the minimum payment. I know that's how that feels. That's not true at all. Get a hold of American Financing and find out how they can help. They are your exit strategy. I'll put it to you that way. 866-891-2821 or AmericanFinancing.net/Jesse. We'll be back. Well, in ugly news, the United Kingdom just raised its terror threat level to severe. And if you dig into the details of it, here's part of the quote. It's driven by an increase in the broader Islamist and extreme right-wing terrorist threat from individuals and small groups. I am very curious to find out which right-wingers might be responsible for these things. Joining me now, Charles Cornish Dale, author of the wonderful book, The Last Men. Hey, Charles, maybe you can enlighten us since you're over there. Which right-wingers have been committing acts of terror?
Look, your guess is as good as mine, Jesse. I don't know. But what I do know is that this is something that the British government does. It does this a lot. Whenever there's a terror attack or there's a threat of a terror attack or there's an opportunity to persecute genuine right-wingers in the UK, then the British government takes it. And, you know, we've seen in recent weeks, we've seen attacks on Jewish people and synagogues in the UK, and that's being used as an excuse to go after the right wing again because, among other things, you know, the Labour government is worried that it is going to take a drubbing from reform in the local elections and that it will probably lose a general election whenever that takes place to reform as well.
Is it going to take a drubbing? Are the people over there just sick and tired of this mass migration of barbarians, of all the rape and the violence? Is the boiling point here?
Well, 2 years ago, then we had, 2 summers ago, then we had, you know, an extraordinary series of riots, mass unrest across the UK, because of the government's policy of housing migrants, illegal migrants, in hotels, in residential buildings, in local communities. The migrants were going out into the local communities, they were being allowed out, and they were committing serious crimes, and especially serious sexual crimes, against young women. And people had enough. I mean, what actually precipitated the riots was the murder, Axel Rudabukana, the son of Rwandan migrants, a teenage boy, went into a dance class with a knife and just started stabbing little girls. He killed, I think it was three, might have been six, but he stabbed over a dozen young girls violently, and that triggered a wave of unrest. So, I mean, people are very, very angry, Jesse. People are definitely very, very angry. It's hard to tell, though, exactly when people are going to kick off. I mean, what I think it takes is a trigger, and the Axel Rudabukana, the murders, that was the trigger. And we're in a situation really where a trigger could happen at any point. You know, a migrant could commit some heinous crime and then, you know, the country could be engulfed in flames. It really does feel like that.
Have you, and I'm assuming the answer to this question is yes, but have you seen the change in your country? Because I know here in the United States of America, there are so many parts of this country that they don't look at all like they used to. You walk around and it's a dirty crap hole. Nobody speaks English. Foreigners everywhere. Litter. It feels unsafe. And it wasn't like that. It seems like it was yesterday. It wasn't like that, but it's like that now. I'm assuming it's like that over there.
Absolutely. I mean, London has changed enormously. You know, the first time I went back to London after the pandemic, so, you know, I went up to London, I think something like 2019, the pandemic happened, and then I didn't go back to London until, I think it was 2023, actually. And I was shocked. I was really shocked at the change. The change was immediately visible. It was visible actually as soon as you hailed a taxi, because every single taxi seemed to be being driven by a non-Londoner, a non-English person. So that was very noticeable, and there were just large, you know, crowds of people, sub-Saharan Africans, kind of milling around, not really doing anything, just kind of loitering in the streets. But it's actually gone far beyond London now. And, you know, once upon a time, one of the benefits of living in the countryside was that you could escape the effects of demographic change. You know, if you lived in a rural part of England like I do, you wouldn't see it. You know, it was still England for all intents and purposes. But actually now, even small towns in rural areas, even villages, you're starting to see demographic change, and it's quite shocking. You know, you'll go to a local town, and there's an African woman carrying her shopping on her head. It's impossible to ignore now.
Are they still arresting people for Facebook posts over there? Because there was a lot of that going on. Please tell me they've reined that in.
Well, I don't think they have. One of the good things, actually, that the Trump administration has done is it's made freedom of speech a central plank of its foreign policy, and especially of its foreign policy with regard to Europe, because, you know, bad things are happening across Europe with regard to freedom of speech. You know, there have been clampdowns not just in Britain, but across the EU. I mean, freedom of speech is considered a real threat to the ruling order in Europe. And the Trump administration, you know, at the Munich Security Conference, first J.D. Vance, and then in a slightly more conciliatory way this year with Marco Rubio, you know, really kind of threw down the gauntlet to Europe and said, you've got to stop doing this. You know, this is harming you. It's harming our relationship. You know, you're betraying your values. You're betraying, you know, the things that made Europe a great civilization. But it does still seem to be going on. As far as I can tell, you do still hear on a kind of weekly basis some kind of horror story of you know, somebody who's been arrested maybe for a Facebook post or a tweet or something. I don't think it's getting better. I mean, I think the government targets in particular working class people, because they're the kind of people who actually go out and burn stuff, basically. You know, I mean, the riots and the unrest that took place, that was working class people. That was ordinary, hard-working Brits, not middle-class Brits, working Brits. And they're the ones that the government particularly targets, I think, online. Doesn't care so much about middle-class Brits, because they're not quite as likely to go out and actually do something when push comes to shove. But yeah, I mean, the situation here is still bad. It's definitely still bad. It hasn't changed. It hasn't got better. And I think, obviously, you know, if the right doesn't win the general election when it comes, could come this year, could come next year, any time up to 2029, if the right doesn't win, then I think there will be a real clampdown after that.
God bless you guys. Charles, hang in there, brother. All right. We have a very, very special Light in the Mood next. Hola, ¿cómo estás? Mi nombre, forget how to say that. Whatever, I'm Jesse, and it's Cinco de Mayo, and I have to wish you a happy Cinco de Mayo, especially to all the Mexicans watching this right now. And since it's Light in the Mood time, I thought I would lighten your mood with the top menu items at one of my favorite restaurants, Mexican restaurants anyway, Taco Bell. First, one that you've been sleeping on, and you have been sleeping on it. The cheesy roll-up. Now, I know what you're thinking. That's kind of a children's order. It would be, except you can add chicken to the cheesy roll-up. When you add the chicken to it, it actually becomes the chicken Mexi-Melt they used to have on the menu. I usually get 3 or 4, just trying to keep my protein numbers up. Number 2, the cheesy gordita crunch. Always a winner. Always sloppy. Make sure you get extra spicy ranch on it. If it's done right, if the gordita is fresh, top notch. And finally, numero uno, as they say in Mexico, Nachos Bel Grande. Now, it's Taco Bell, so you got to be careful when you're adding things or taking things away, because you understand the person who's making your food is probably mentally challenged. You want to lose the sour cream, because sour cream's disgusting. You sit down, Nachos Bel Grande, top notch. Buenas tardes, everybody.
on demand.
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty on demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.